I think we'll start because it's time, and I'd like to. It's not picking it up. I think we'll start. Those of you who are interested in this session, will you come a little bit closer, because we're going to have some time for some audience participation. And I think it'd be a little more helpful if we were closer together. Apparently there was a volume problem, and that's another reason maybe that you should come a little closer. And then perhaps if someone in the back could close the door, that would also be helpful in cutting down the noise. I think so. Oh. Can you hear in the back? Okay, we'll just start. This is panel 176 on the challenges facing the international church. I'm Marianne Morgan. I'm the moderator of the panel. And we have four panelists. Brooke Durr, who teaches at the University of Utah. He's director of Global Business Program at the David Eccles School of Business. Joseph Black, who is a former director of social services for the Rockefeller Foundation, and has had major assignments and worked in Africa and Indonesia. David Knowlton, who is a cultural anthropologist, has been teaching at BYU and will be a professor of sociology at the University of Texas in Austin. And Michael Homer, who was one of the first missionaries to serve in Italy and is an attorney in Salt Lake City. We would like to take initially, I've asked the panelists to take 10 to 12 minutes to make a statement, and then we'd like to have some interaction from you about the cultural differences and the problems that creates in an international church. Sometimes I think, we have two sons who are serving missions, and when I think of how naive they are, I just wonder of the social faux pas that even adults, and especially 19-year-old boys, would make. And we want to focus here on the differences between, I guess we could use the word culture of Jesus Christ, between importing or exporting the gospel of Jesus Christ and not exporting the American culture. And so those are the things that we'll explore. So I think we'll just go in the order that we're listed on the program. We'll hear first from Brooke, then Joseph Black, then David Knowlton, and Michael Homer. Thanks.
It will probably be useful at the beginning for me to just give you some context for my remarks. We lived in not very different cultures. We lived in France as a family in 1985, where I had previously served a mission. And in Lausanne, Switzerland for 2.5 years from 1989 through 1991. And a lot of what I'm going to say is based upon our experience there, although while in France I also conducted some research that appeared in a Dialogue article in 1988. I've been trying to find a sort of framework for this. And let me just suggest one at the start, which might help me in the conclusion. I'd like to talk about different aspects of culture, and maybe one way to pose this is to use a business example, which will get us into the church. A rhetorical question. Is a Frenchman working at Shell, which is an Anglo-Dutch oil company with a very strong company culture, very normative, very obtrusive, very socializing. Is a Frenchman working at Shell more like a Brit working at Shell or more like another Frenchman working at Exxon, which is also a very, very strong normative culture? I'll try to come back and respond to that in a minute. But the reason I wanted to put that out as just a sort of place to begin is that one framework that I like is a framework suggested by Edgar Schein of MIT, where he talks about the notion of cultural depth. And what Schein says is there are, in his experience from studying organizations anthropologically, three levels of culture. The first is rather superficial and easy to observe. You go into the LDS Church on East South Temple, and you observe everyone is wearing dark blue suits with white shirts and as a kind of thing. And he would say, well, that's just your first layer of the onion, and he would call that artifact culture. It's what we often talk about when we go abroad and we see this and we see that. It's rather easy to observe. It's harder to interpret what it means. For example, I was having dinner with some Exxon executives, and they were going to pay the bill, and they said, would you let us use your pen? And I gave them a pen, and they said, aha, if you were at Exxon USA, we'd know what kind of a person you are by this pen. Seems really bizarre. But so that was easy enough to observe that they have a thing about pens. I didn't know what it meant, and I had to call my informer to tell me that they have a dinner once a year, and the CEO gives out pens, and your order in the pecking, or your place in the pecking order depends on the kind of pen. I was down to about 500, I think. Anyway, then Schein says there's another level of culture called values and norms culture. And this is harder to study. It's mostly inferred. It's much deeper. But it maybe explains more of the culture. It has to do with really values and beliefs, in organizational sense, taboos and limits, what people really look at in terms of choosing who gets promoted, what are the things that really count, creeds, mottos, logos, the stories that you tell to newcomers to socialize them into the organization, and really the dominant themes of the organization. So you could say, and I'll just use these examples for a minute and then get right to the church, you could say there is such a thing as the IBM way, and whether you're French or British or the Shell way or the Exxon way, and whether you're French, British, or whatever, people conform to that set of values, and you don't have to be around those people very often to tell that they have been socialized into values, a way of thinking, a kind of thing that they believe. But Schein says that at the very bottom of the iceberg, there is a level of culture which is very difficult to study. It's almost invisible, unconscious, taken for granted. But it's the very meaningful why of the culture, and he calls this basic assumption or core culture. So to return for just a minute to my example, what we would start to believe, and that's what I'm going to use to spring off of my church thing, is that the Frenchman working at Shell is more like the Brit working at Shell on at least the first superficial level of culture, the way the person dresses, the way they send memos, the way they talk. Maybe even somewhat on the second level of culture, what they value in that normative organization, what they socialize. But on that third deep level of culture, the Frenchman at Shell is much more like the Frenchman at Exxon than the Brit at Shell. And you can take a whole bunch of studies that ask very, very basic questions, and you get the most significant differences on culture, on passport. If you take one like this, I mean, most of us would think absurd. Most organizations would be better off if conflict could be eliminated forever. Well, most people working in organizations. In the U.S., only 4% of the respondents would agree with that statement. They'd say conflict's normal, natural, it just happens, you have to work it through. But in France, 24% of the people would agree with that statement, and in Italy, 42%. So you start to get a lot of differences at this very core level. Now let me jump off very quickly on my remarks. I found three levels of cultural perspective in the church. One is the difference between the French and Swiss that we knew as Mormons and other French and Swiss. And there I thought there were really significant differences. I think because the church intervenes at that second level, at the values and beliefs level, it's really quite a deep intervention if you think about it. And I would say that the French and Swiss generally that we knew would be much more like other very believing religious people in that cultural context than they would be like non-believers in that cultural context. If you think of who joins the church in Europe, I mean, it's a real polyglot. Mostly they're Africans nowadays. Every ward, it's very difficult to say, it's French, it's Swiss, whatever. They're from Chile, they're from Portugal, they're from North Africa. One of the problems in the European church is there are few common nationalities existing as a core. But in that sense, I would say that that our people, the LDS people, would be very much their own people in the sense of believers in something as strange as religion. I saw a survey 3 months ago showing that Americans had by far the highest participation in any kind of organized religion of people in the world, and much, much greater participation than did Europeans. So to even belong to a church is a weird thing in Europe, and I think that would be the case. On the other hand, on the research that I did, one of the interesting things is that the French members of the church were much more like other French than like LDS members from America on such things as balance between personal and professional life. There was a kind of notion of a French way of doing things, the 30 days holiday and spending a really quality time with family, taking time out, which was very different from the American perspective of taking a long weekend as a vacation. I mean, it was very much of a French versus American. And they were much more like other French in terms of putting boundaries around private life and not letting work spill over into private life than they were American LDS. The second level is French and Swiss Mormons versus American Mormons, which I think is the kickoff that Marianne used. And here you can see, of course, an awful lot of common things along the belief system. Just the lifestyle, word of wisdom is very differentiating, the way people try to believe in a sense of family home evening, Book of Mormon, the temple is very different, all of those sorts of things. But here is the place where I think both the French and the Swiss are very, very different from each other, and they're very, very different from American Mormons. It's at this very basic, deep level. For example, if you ask French and Swiss, if you ask Americans, because as Schein said, it's really sort of at that taken-for-granted level. If you ask Americans to describe American core values, they'll tell you there's no such thing. You know, they're African-Americans, Asian-Americans, blah, 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 blah. If you ask Europeans, they'll tell you very quickly, Americans are incredibly preoccupied with equality and legality. They're just so hung up on feminism, racism, sex orientation, equal opportunity that it seems really bizarre to us. If you ask Europeans, they'll say that Americans are not team players. They're totally individualistic. If you ask Europeans, they'll say Americans are hung up on short-term time perspective. They take no long-term orientation, short-term results. Americans define everything as a game, even the Gulf War, with winners and losers and goals and football strategies. Americans, this is a positive thing, are the only culture in the world that seems really entrepreneurial. Americans are internationally and culturally naive. They just discovered their passport 6 months ago. They go around in huge buses and tour the world in 10 days. Well, the best example we had was taking in some kids, friends of ours who were Euro-railers, and bragged that they had seen Vienna in 18 minutes. It was something like the world record. Now, in that regard, the French are very, very different. The French are preoccupied with social class and an elite system that leads to the Grandes Écoles. When the missionaries bring people to church, the members look them over. It's not a race issue. They will accept black, white, there's no race. But they will look them over, and if they're not of a certain social class, they will snub them because they don't want those kinds of people closely associated. The French are like Americans with a fierce sense of individuality and privacy. The French are very much oriented towards social justice and welfare state, and the lessons that have to do with self-sufficiency and everything seem bizarre. The French are essentially focused on aesthetics, sensuality, quality of life, It's a relationship culture. Joe said it was the most feminine culture she'd ever been part of. This really spilled over into the church. People would come to church. They were all part of a family. There were huge relationships. They'd stay on for 4 and 5 hours after church, bring their picnic. during the home teaching, you had to make long schedules in advance because they could not receive you into their home for 20-minute visits. It took 3 hours. And therefore, if you saw somebody every quarter, that was about as much time as you could deal with, and they could deal with you. The people in the summer, the whole church closes down. It's a wonderful thing. Période de vacances. They give out little lessons for all the families. They assume they're going away for a month and they won't go to church. It just kind of closes down. The stake president in France, he kind of came down there. He was in a bishopric, had mud on his shoes, kind of his ties out, and he stands up there and asks the people to sustain, as part of the word conference, the general authorities, two of whom were dead. I had to tell him. He said, oh, I'll be it's a really different place. When you go to Switzerland, it's a very militaristic, and there, here Jill makes the comment, it's the most masculine culture she has ever encountered. They're very efficient, preoccupied with technical competence and technical quality, incredible hard workers. They're called the Japanese of Europe. Even the French-speaking Swiss were ruled by the Bernese for 200 years. They are very rule-bound. They are just incredibly rule-bound. I mean, they make Utah look like libertarians. They love hierarchy. They love elites. They love authority systems. And in the church, for example, I could speak French good enough that I'd go for the bishop. I was the first counselor to a bishop's meeting because he was a Sicilian tailor and he couldn't leave his work on Saturdays. And so we're all talking French, and the bishop's meeting says, look, whatever you do, don't trust any American Mormons who come into your ward. Look them over for at least 6 months to a year because American Mormons are very sloppy. They're very sloppy livers of the gospel. We go to Salt Lake. They're in shorts. They're drinking these big gulp things. they're having all these strange intellectual discussions. And just watch these guys. These guys are very bad Mormons. the Swiss are, they did things like, if you want to say social class, we had Swiss members in our ward who would come to church and everything, but would not come to the social events because they didn't want their kids to socialize with the people that weren't in the class. One branch, while I was there, went on a fast that the Lord would not send them any more African saints. On the priesthood meetings and the setting apart, there would be huge... They bring their handbook of instructions and debate the rules. I mean, if you brought an investigator, it would just, time out. There's no way. Elder Perry came to Geneva and made one of the best interventions I've ever seen. The women were just serving everybody food. They were working all day, and Elder Perry said, hey, wait a minute. This isn't right. Why don't we serve ourselves? Give the women a break. They have their own meetings. And just lighten up a little bit. I mean, we don't have to... there would be meetings called for the stake that would start at 12 at noon and end at 12 at night on Saturdays. I mean, it was really something. So you can see the difference with the French and Swiss. You can also see the difference with Americans. And the third level, how did we change... Or American Mormon expatriates versus American Mormons are like Americans in the mission field. But for Switzerland and France was fantastic for us because... I think that was the place where we came to our own kind of orthodoxy in the church. It's wonderful to leave Utah. It's wonderful to get away from all of these debates. It's wonderful to get down in the trenches at a very basic level where people are, where your major preoccupations have to do with people trying to survive and you trying to help them survive. It's wonderful to make very basic decisions about whether or not you're in this thing or not, at a really deep level. And that was fantastic for us. And it was also very difficult to come back. The first thing that we found was very frightening, to be back in this huge ward. And the second thing we found was, when I was a high priest group leader, about half the people in Utah just seemed so underutilized. They were just on automatic pilot. And the church was 3 hours every Sunday. And it was just kind of a bizarre thing after that kind of commitment. My time is way up. The questions that I'd like to pose, is there over time a rapprochement in these core cultural values at this deep level? Is there a kingdom of God culture? Some of my colleagues at the church believe that there is. They believe they have some data in the research committee that can show this, and I think that's an idea that we're all concerned about. Is there something like a hybrid culture? Is there a French Mormon and a Swiss Mormon culture that is not an American Mormon culture? The culture really helps us put big issues in perspective. It helps us to enlarge our perspective. And I think you can't go abroad and come back and look at things from a narrow, unidimensional point of view. What could the church do to better integrate? Well, of course, it can re-examine what these American core values are versus gospel core values. There are lots of things that my colleagues will talk about, but I'd also like to say that I think it's doing quite a bit as well. In France, for example, the way the LDS members get around the elite system is by sending their kids to BYU. It's a really important vehicle for them to get around this incredible blockage. Just a week ago was the 5th Annual Church and World Affairs Conference at BYU in the David M. Kennedy Center with Elder Morrison and Elaine Jack talking about, I was hungered and you gave me meat. I know the BYU School of Management is actively addressing the whole issue of how you develop train managerial leaders in the underdeveloped world. I think on Saturday is a wonderful session by Enterprise Mentors on the work they're doing with LDS people in the Philippines, Brazil, and India. And I think that I don't really have any answers, but it's at this level of this deep culture that you really catch the interesting points of the church when you're living abroad. Thank you very much.
My deep interest in cultural values, differences in various countries and so on, really grew as a result of my personal experience as well as academic exercises and what I learned that way. My fundamental message is that we need greater understanding of other people. We need to not just stereotypes, are synthetic little answers that are sufficient. I'm always amazed at how prejudice simply is based on a very simplistic concept of other people or other cultures. Oh, they are lazy. They just want to sleep. Or this, when you talk about the problems. As you grow to understand other people more, it becomes a great enrichment for your own life and your own feeling about yourself and the people close to you. My journey, and it continues, in trying to understand others and myself, involves both academic and personal experiences. Academic and continuing study to have more information and better conceptual framework to understand other people. The comments just made by the last panelist in talking about different depths that you have to think about. And my personal experiences started living in Navajo country, San Juan County, but then in different regions of the world, including East Africa, Nairobi, Kenya, Tanzania, and then a much longer stay in Nigeria, but also Zaire. Finally, Asian experiences, the longest one being Indonesia, but lots of others, and then a number of experiences in Latin America. And I will not try to go through each one of these. And, of course, then back in the States for a long time working with African Americans and with other racial groups and problems they were having. Given the short time I have, I don't think that I dare even go into some of these personal stories. I may have to tell one to conclude, because a lot of my understanding of these other cultures and the conflict of the church and the other people grew exactly out of little stories or incidents that I was involved in. I served in the branch presidency in Yogyakarta, Indonesia, and it was very interesting to have the personal experiences living there and interacting with the church, which was a long ways away as far as they were concerned, and it was as far as we were concerned as well. So I don't forget it. I'll just tell you one little story. The big problem was getting a chapel in Yogyakarta. I had the only telephone in our branch and the only automobile. So all at once I'd have a call from Jakarta, would I meet somebody at the airport. I'd go to the airport and pick someone up who is coming to look at lots. I pick him up at the airport and he says, "Well, Brother Black, what's the name of this town where we are?" I said, "This town is Yogyakarta. Our district of Yogyakarta has a population over three times that of Utah." "So it's a village?" "Yes, a village." Then I say to him, "On the way to looking at these spots, could we stop by, there's at least six other chapels being underway in this area. But there's also some Muslim mosques. Could we just drive by them so you could see them?" "Oh, I have no interest in those. Let's go directly to the lot where we are." So that's what I do. He's appalled at the cost of the lots. "How could they cost so much?" "Well, 4 million people crowded into this area, into this district. That obviously makes a difference." "Well, you know, this is a rather poor area, Brother Black. So I'll tell you what we're going to have to do. We're going to have to use the model we developed for the Philippines, and we're going to have to build a chapel out of wood. And this is the model that we have on what we're going to do." I said, "Well, that's very interesting, because, you know, building it out of wood will cost at least 4 to 6 times as much as it would out of brick." I said, "Did you see all those lots we drove past where they were making brick?" I said, "Where is the wood, given this population?" Just a little bit of hardwood for export. So this goes on and on, this kind of a story. But you are trying to interact with the church, and some are not understanding these basic things. All right. In looking at the title of Challenges Facing the International Church, I will have to list just about three of these and not go into any more of these stories or even continue that one to its incredible conclusion. Finish it? All right, right at the end of it, finally, we were able to find a place that it was a great old Dutch mansion, because the Dutch had ruled there, and we were able to get it purchased and then, using native labor, to get it finally organized into a way, and their living room and dining room taken out of the wall, gave us a chapel space and everything, and it looked just fantastic. However, 3 years ago, my wife and I went back to Indonesia. The building had been destroyed, and they were building a chapel that looked just like those we built right along here, because it didn't look like a Mormon meeting house. That's the end of it. Let me tell you four parameters that hit me very hard in going into this topic, and I will not discuss them at all. One, the rapid growth of the church and expectations that will continue. To think of a church when I was a little boy of 300,000 and now 9 million, and projections of an increasingly international church. Administering a correlated church down to the nth degree in this many areas of the world and this growth is simply an incredible and an awesome problem. Maybe it'll even be less correlation, I don't know, but it's still very interesting. But a mingling of cultures and the extraordinary opportunity to learn more about other peoples, and it seems to me in the context of all this, in talking about cultures and understanding others, cultures are also based into economics, their history, and their geography. It is not just a matter of saying, "Oh, I sure like Indonesian food or some other food, or I like this." What are these things that count on the way people live, the way they survive, the way they get along, and all these other things? That's what strikes me very deeply. And unless we can understand a little bit about the history of these other peoples and the origins of their culture and do it in depth, the other isn't going to work. Another challenge for the International Church: political unrest in the world. The simplistic view that the problems would end with the end of communism and then we could somehow do all these great things didn't take into account some of the other things that are happening: religious, national, ethnic, and other conflicts. And there is no way, and I'm thinking about this in terms not just of Rwanda and Zaire, because the church made a big investment in the Zaire and the church there, but also whether it be the former Yugoslavia. So it does take a lot of sophistication in talking about what's happening. When I speak to groups, they'll always say, well, why on earth did this happen? Because they had in their mind, once communism disappeared, then somehow democracy would reign and we were going to be happy and the church could move forth to fill the earth. Yes, it can, but there are these challenges. Let me just mention one other one, because my time is up. And that is the challenge of increasing inequality in the world. In many countries where we work, it's also true in the United States. The increasing inequality in the world, a world of the rich and the poor, a problem for a well-integrated church. When you just try to conceive of this, classes were mentioned as regard to France and Switzerland. But I must tell you, if you have lived in Nigeria and are still connected there as I am, to try to deal with the problems of poverty elsewhere in some parts of Africa where population is growing so rapidly, I am not able to divorce myself from the population issues and the Cairo conference that takes place just a month from now on dealing worldwide with the problems of women, the one of gender, and population growth, and what it means to society. The church and all of us have to use the word sustainability. What is sustainable? Because lots of times we cannot understand the African problems without thinking about that. And both the population, desertification of the land, and the other things that are occurring. Because even though the missionaries can do great things, we still have to live in an environmental context where these things are taking place. Yes, all are alike unto God, but we have to understand our brothers and sisters more, and it will help us develop as well as help us to deal with these problems that exist. Thank you.
I was asked to be on this panel last week when I returned from Bolivia, the issues of this panel are very fresh in my mind from having gone to church in Bolivia and talked to quite a number of people who are at various levels of the church. And as I've listened, I have a swirling chaos of ideas, but they kind of come around one core issue. I think that we have yet to begin to cope with the complexities of the issues of culture and dealing in an international framework. As Brother Black just said, culture is something, a dance troupe or a food you eat. Culture, as the first speaker said, is extremely deep and superficial simultaneously. One example that I like to use with students is that dealing with people of other cultures in many ways is like looking at an Escher painting. You know the one where you look at it once and you see fish floating across the screen? You look at it again and you see geese. You look at it again and you see fish. You look at it again and you see geese. But never can you simultaneously see both fish and geese. One anthropologist wrote about a society that I'm familiar with in Bolivia that looks at the night sky, and instead of constellations made of stars that you connect by lines, by drawing dots or drawing lines between the dots of the stars as we do, They look at the empty spaces. In other words, they have the opposite view that we have. Culture goes to the very core of human existence. It has to do with the way we live, the way we eat, the way we breathe, the way we think, the way we see. It also lives in an institutional matrix. It's constantly shifting and changing. Sometimes it's objectified. Many times it isn't. People argue about culture. They fight about it. At the same time, they live it and are dependent on it. When I say that we haven't yet to begin to deal with the issue of culture, by that I mean in part that we have yet to deal with the fact that the church is culture. When we talk about the church, we're using an abstraction. There is no such thing as the church, other than as we symbolically create it in our minds at the moment of speaking. There are a lot of people who interact. There is a bureaucracy that works. Connecting that are many different norms and values and many different systems. But when we invoke the term the church, we speak as if we were talking about something monolithic, something that exists and is concrete as this watch that I have. Unfortunately, that's an artifact of language that's extremely confusing. And it confuses us when we talk about the transplantation of the church elsewhere. What do we mean when we talk about that? What do we mean when we talk about the churches interacting with other cultural values? In part, we have to decide what we're delimiting by the term church. That is a political question. The yes is being dealt with in the church office building, that in some ways is being dealt with by this panel. But I don't think yet we still get to the difficulty of the fact that the church itself is culture. To speak of the contradiction between an American culture and a gospel culture is nonsense. It makes no sense. Other than to the degree that the church is separate from the United States. But again, we're dealing with an abstraction that isn't that separable. If we talk about a gospel culture, it's because we create it. We make it. If we had the mind of the Lord, perhaps we could speak with the Lord's mind. But the minute we translate it into another language, we've made it culture. It is no longer the same. I was astounded in Bolivia about 3 weeks ago to be talking to a young man who had just finished being in the bishopric, and he was relaying a conversation with another bishop at a stake meeting. This young man has been a missionary, been very active in the church for a long time, been a convert to the church, been close to 20 years that he's been involved in the church. He was saying that the other bishop, who is also very active in stake leadership, said to him, "Well, you know, you really ought to hurry up, Juan Carlos, and become a bishop. I mean, you know, when one is a bishop, one has all the ability of being able to build a house and to get a car and so on and so on. How? Well, it's obvious. You don't have to turn in the tithing receipts or the fast offering receipts for a month. You have a month to work the money. And in that month, you can make plenty of money to help yourself out." None of them really saw the conflict apparent in this image. Very clearly, between what we here in the United States will simply see as corruption and not tenable for a bishop. But yet to these particular young people in Latin America, it was very much part and parcel of the job, part things to be simply taken for granted. When we translate the church into another context, another culture, those values become integrated to the degree they're successful into that other culture. Thereby, they become syncretized, to use a new word, a big technical word. That is that parts of them maintain things that we can look at as symbols to say, yes, these people are still good members of the church. But much else is lost in the contextualization. They become reconfigured. They take on new meanings, new frames, according to the culture that hosts them. I interviewed the mission president of the La Paz Bolivia Mission, who is a native Austrian, but really Bolivian. I gave him his baptismal interview 20 years ago. He's been in Bolivia since 30 years. His main concern, besides meeting the need for proselyting, was how he could engage the people of the Altiplano and develop them agriculturally. We had a long conversation, not about the church or the faithfulness of the members. That was 5 minutes. His interest was to go on for 2 hours and discuss what one could do using the church to develop the Altiplano, the very impoverished people of Bolivia, agriculturally. It reminded me of a couple years ago when I spoke with the head of the presiding bishopric's office, who is now the mission president in Lima, who is also a native Bolivian. He said, frankly, the American leaders of the church don't know what we need here in Bolivia. But as we grow in the church, we will develop our own Latin American plans, and we'll carry them out. Aren't you worried about church headquarters finding this out? No, because we will be the critical mass, and we'll be able to carry out a Latin American church. In a sense, by talking in this term of cultural politics within the church, the presiding bishopric officer was more aware of the complexities of translating the gospel into other milieus than we are. In part because he's aware that the gospel takes a different frame and a different function within different social locations and social milieus. Another example, we take for granted that that religion is a useful category, that it means something. We take for granted that the way of approaching God is through worship. We take for granted that one way of worshiping is going to meetings on Sundays. How do you translate this into a Catholic culture where everyday life is part of living out a message that, or living out the frames of sacrality? Namely, where what you do in everyday life, you're simply living out the pattern that Christ put. The important thing is not, I'm talking about popular religion, not formal Catholicism, where it's not so important that you go to Mass every Sunday or whenever. But if you go four times in life, but you periodically go to feast days and you periodically make pilgrimages and what haven't, as well as paying attention to crossing yourself as you cross by an altar, gruta as they're called, a grotto, then you're being a good person. If you have values and norms in your everyday life, you're a good person. This came to me very clearly when I was looking at a survey done by a sociologist of religion in La Paz. And he pointed out that 40% of the people, of the heads of household in a suburban neighborhood of La Paz, consider themselves non-Catholic now. And of the Mormons, the majority of the heads of households he interviewed were not, by any measure of religiosity, active in the church. But they considered themselves good Mormons. In other words, is it necessary to go to meetings, to be active in your church callings, to be a good Mormon? Obviously, to these people, it was not. This study would seem to indicate that we're developing, that they're developing a culture of Mormonism in Bolivia that is a different culture, somewhat more like the popular Catholic culture than ours. The problem they're going to face is the cultural politics and the conflicts with leaders who would like a different definition for other purposes and other reasons, which will lead to perhaps redefinition and change. But in the meantime, we have many heads of household who may not have been to church in years, may drink, may whatever, but consider themselves Mormons. Pardon me? There's a culture in Latin America for women to be much more religious, as it's almost expected, and for women to be very involved in the church. I remember when I was a missionary in Bolivia, the church was composed almost entirely of women and very few men. And that when men would come when they were leaders, then when they were released from leadership positions, they would disappear. And as missionaries, we always commented, what happens to these people? Don't they understand there has to be this recycling? You know, I really don't know the answer to why the men would disappear, nor why only women were there much of the time. I know now that's not the case. You see a lot of young 24, 25-year-old men who are bishops, but even so, many of those will rotate out and become inactive once they're still leaders. But there's still a lot more men than there used to be. I'm not really answering your question. Let me say this, and then I may come back to it. I don't know the answer. Without doing a study, I hesitate to say really what women are or are not doing. I want to talk about women in a different sense in just a minute. One issue in terms of culture and why men would disappear after having leadership positions has to do with issues of shame and honor. In other words, by losing the position, a man would lose a certain amount of honor. And the question is, how do you maintain the sense of honor without shaming the person? Because I remember very clearly talking to a number of these people, and they had felt shamed by losing their position. And as they had no more position, no more prestige, they had to disappear, not be present. And in fact, a person who is a good person in Latin America is a person with a lot of vergüenza, meaning that when they have shame, they don't show their face. A person who's appropriate is one who stays back, doesn't move forward in moments where they are suffering vergüenza. Your question about women is a very interesting one. It's very difficult for me to answer because, first of all, I'm male, and secondly, I haven't done the studies. But I know that in the Relief Society in the area of La Paz where I've done field work, the women would spend much time transforming the lessons to deal with very practical issues involving, in many cases, health care. One of the major concerns among women across the Altiplano is health care, family issues, gynecological concerns, and so on, and particularly the demand for information. What they were doing was sacralizing, or they were syncretizing the gospel with traditional Aymara indigenous folk wisdom about healing. And then they were Mormonizing it by giving it the seal of approval of the gospel. So they were creating a new discourse within Relief Society that had very little to do with what was going on elsewhere. I know that very strong women in Bolivia have as much trouble as they do elsewhere in the church. And forgive me for not answering your question, because it really requires very good studies. And I'd like to close by this final point. If we don't really understand yet what's happening with culture, let me propose that we really don't know very much at all about the international church. We sent thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of missionaries out who come back with very partial knowledge, very partial information. Many of us have worked in the third world. I've spent a lot of time studying issues related to this, but my studies are focused on specific issues. And there are many, many things we don't know. We need to replicate lots and lots of work to figure out what is going on in the church. Why are people joining this crazy institution? What kinds of people join it? In other words, who do we select? And why do they select us? What are the cultural advantages and disadvantages? To tell you another cynical story, one leader of the church in La Paz, a rather high leader, was reputed years ago to have joined the church and been very clear with his friends that he joined simply for material advantage. And as a result of his association with the church and church construction, he's gotten fantastically wealthy. His non-Mormon friends say he's very clear that he joined simply for wealth, for social advantage, although that's not the way he's seen by the members. Do people join for those reasons? You better believe they do. Does it work? Yes, it does. What does that say about the church? What do other reasons for joining say about the church? Do people have to join only for spirituality or for what we would consider good reasons? What is the nature of the institutional church in other settings? Is it simply as we assume it is, as it is here in the Wasatch Front or elsewhere? Or does it have a very different nature? Is it a different beast? How do we communicate in reality across these lines of culture and difference? Because one of the interesting facts of culture is that people do indeed talk with each other, even when they don't share a common language. I mean, I sat on the train in Peru and watched amazing conversations occur between people who had no common language, when I could speak both languages, and yet somehow they were managing to communicate simply, but at one level they communicated. There's difference and there's communication, similarity. So how does communication actually occur? How does the church bureaucracy function? Or dysfunction or misfunction? Do people in the world really have to be like us? In other words, what is the minimum that is required for being a Mormon? What are we going to do when we have the commandment of the Lord to carry the gospel to all nations, kindreds, tongues, and peoples, and yet simply the gospel won't work as we understand it in those cultures? Do we change the gospel? Do we change the church to fit? Or do we demand over time that those people change? That's part of the quandary of the church being culture. This is like in the beginning when the Lord gave Adam and Eve impossible commands. Multiply and replenish the earth. Don't eat of the tree of fruit knowledge of good and evil. I know Talmadge doesn't like to see them contradictory, but traditional Christian wisdom sees them as mutually contradictory. In a sense, the command to carry the gospel to everybody is a contradiction in terms. How are we going to meet that contradiction is really the challenge for the future. One final point. What are we going to do as Anglo-Americans when the prophet speaks Spanish, when the church bureaucracy is predominantly Spanish speaking and dances to a Latin American rhythm? When there is a new gospel that's created out of the strains of the South instead of the strains of the North. How are we going to respond? Because is it legitimate to have a Wasatch Front culture that is Mormon? You better believe it is. And for us to try to separate the gospel from our culture is a very difficult task. And in the process, we will lose a lot of people. Is there anything wrong with the Wasatch Front culture and the gospel? Not at all. It's perfectly fine in its home domain. It works very well. And we need it. It helps us. But what we have to do is somehow be able to recognize diversity, be able to communicate across difference, be able to deal with the quandaries of syncretism, where people don't sing Come Come You Saints, where, as we see it, where they sing it to different melodies, if they sing the words at all, where they worship gods that are almost unrecognizable to us, although they use them out of the Book of Mormon, or whatever, and yet still call it the same church. In a sense, we're going to have to do what the Catholic Church has been very successful at doing over the last 2,000 years, or the Islamic movement has been very successful at doing, two of the biggest and most growing world religions. That is to cope with the problems of diversity while maintaining unity. What does it mean to be Mormon? What is unity? What is the minimum that we're going to require? And how are we going to require it when people can so easily hide cultural differences from us? Thank you.
I'm going to take a little bit different approach. My remarks will not center on spreading the message or whether more means better, but instead I'll try to concentrate on legal issues relevant to church expansion into countries which have traditionally had either state-sponsored religions or, in the case of Eastern Europe, which is of particular interest to me right now, state-sponsored anti-religion. And I would like to utilize the Italian experience as an example to demonstrate that growth in those types of countries can depend on the willingness of the church to either challenge or accommodate those traditions. And I'm going to concentrate on legal traditions. Lorenzo Snow had been an apostle for less than 1 year when he was called by Brigham Young during the 1849 October conference to establish a mission in Italy. When he reached Liverpool in April 1850, Snow began to consider how best to spread the gospel in that area, which, as Metternich had said, was a mere geographical expression. It consisted of a patchwork of separate but geographically contiguous political entities, united in language, somewhat, loyalty to the Catholic Church, somewhat, and hostility to outside missionaries, a lot. Snow's interest was piqued by a group that must have seemed a welcome exception, and that is the Waldensians, which were a Protestant group living in the Piedmont region of the Sardinian states, where certain civil liberties had been granted to them only 2 years earlier. In the second edition of John Murray's A Handbook for the Travelers in Switzerland and the Alps of Savoy and Piedmont, published in 1838, the Waldensians were described as, quote, a far superior and more of character to the Roman Catholic inhabitants. They are from ancient habit honest, civil, and quiet, and from their situation and necessity simple and laborious. In addition, the Religious Tract Society, headquartered in London, which had been publishing since 1799, had published in 1846 a book entitled Sketches of the Waldensians, which reflected the common Protestant belief that the Waldensians provided a, quote, chain by which our Reformed churches are connected with the first disciples of Christ. It also stated that they were, quote, preserved for a special purpose in the divine council, destined to fulfill a most important mission in the evangelization of Italy. Well, not surprisingly, those were meaty words for Lorenzo Snow. And in 1850, the Waldensians were, for all practical purposes, the only Protestant denomination in the Italian peninsula. They traced their origin to the 12th century, although at the time many Protestants in Europe believe that they actually began at the time of the apostles. But in any event, it had taken them more than 600 years of existence to achieve any legal legitimacy in Italy. 2 years before Snow arrived, Carlo Alberto, the King of Sardinia, granted his subjects, Catholic and non-Catholic, greater freedoms, including freedom of the press and of association. In addition, for the first time, the Waldensians were granted some religious toleration, not religious liberty, since they could choose their own professions for the first time, attend schools of higher learning for the first time, and, which was quite a radical concept, acquire property. But the king did not guarantee religious liberties or the freedom of press enjoyed in England and the United States, something that was misunderstood by Lorenzo Snow when he came into Italy. The rights enumerated by the king were limited to civil rights. Although this decree has been interpreted as an expression of religious toleration, it did not guarantee the free exercise of religion as we understand it now, both in the United States and in Western culture. In fact, the Catholic Church was expressly made, quote, the sole religion of the state, and Bibles, catechisms, and liturgical books could not be published without the permission of the local bishop. Now, unlike the Protestants of Europe who came to Italy shortly after the Mormons, and by the way, the Mormons were the first outside religious groups to begin proselyting in Italy. For example, the Wesleyans came in 1861, the Baptists in 1863, the Methodists in 1871. Those groups, however, did not attempt to convert the Waldensians, but sought their help in evangelizing the Catholics of Italy. Lorenzo Snow, on the other hand, sought first to convert the Waldensians and then to send forth the new converts to proselyte the larger Catholic population. Of course, there were other churches which were also interested in converting the Waldensians, which sent missionaries to the valleys at that time, including the Adventists in 1864, the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in 1871, and the Jehovah's Witnesses in the 1880s. Since this form of proselyting was illegal, and the legitimacy of Mormonism and all other non-Catholic ministers was not recognized, some cunning on the part of Lorenzo Snow was required. In 1851, he published a tract in French, because that was the language that was spoken in Piedmont, and included upon it a woodcut of a Catholic nun, anchor, lamp, and cross on the first page, and on the last, Noah's Ark, the dove, and the olive. The publisher undoubtedly provided the woodcut, and Snow was mistaken when he referred to a lamp on the woodcut, since it was actually an ostentorium or monstrous. In any case, Snow willingly broke the law rather than acquiesce to the illiberal prohibitions against his missionary activities. Because of these limitations on religious liberties, the first Mormon missionaries in Italy experienced many difficulties when they attempted to proselyte outside of the Waldensian valleys. As long as they attempted to proselyte Waldensians, their efforts were ignored, except perhaps by Waldensian pastors. When they proselyted among the Catholics in Nice, which at the time was part of the Sardinian states, Genoa, or Turin, they were expelled from the country. These conditions caused Snow to observe that liberty is only yet in the bud, and the bud may yet have a bitter taste. And since his presence in the kingdom of Sardinia was only just tolerated and not recognized as any right founded upon established laws, lack of freedom and converts resulted in a short-lived mission. During its 17-year history, the Italian mission produced only 184 converts. Following the closure of the mission in 1867, there were only scattered attempts to find additional converts in Italy during the next 100 years. Interestingly, shortly after the departure of the Mormons from Italy, Giuseppe Garibaldi, acting on behalf of the King of Sardinia, successfully captured Rome from the Pope. With the capture of Rome, the Kingdom of Italy achieved most of its current boundaries. Although this effectively ended the Church's domination of political affairs over Rome and the Papal States and Rome and the Papal States, and King Victor Emmanuel II, his ministers, and all members of Parliament were excommunicated by Pius IX, all Catholics were prohibited by the Pope from participating in any future elections. Ironically, the Statuto of Carlo Alberto, which made the Catholic religion the sole religion of the state, remained in effect, which is one thing that a lot of people don't understand about Italian politics. It recognizes Catholicism, but is very anti-clerical. Catholicism remained the only recognized church in Italy, which was no longer merely at that time a geographical expression. Although Mormonism at that time abandoned Italy and what effectively amounted to illegal proselyting activities, missionaries from other denominations, which had arrived in Italy at the same time, remained. They refused to leave, established a foothold, which would only bear fruit in the 20th century, and which, in my opinion, is the reason that those religions find themselves in much greater numbers than Mormons do today. In 1929, Mussolini negotiated the Lateran Treaty with the Vatican, which not only recognized Vatican City as a sovereign state, but also reaffirmed that the Catholic Church was the state church. When the Kingdom of Italy was replaced with the Republic of Italy in 1946, the new constitution continued to recognize the Lateran Treaty, but also granted religious liberty to minority religions for the first time. This opened the door for legalized proselytism in Italy for the first time and the recognition of minority religions for tax purposes, land ownership, and the validity of marriages performed by non-Catholic ministers. The Catholic Church, however, remained the official Church of Italy. As in other countries, the next organization of Mormons in Italy consisted of Americans living overseas. And I will skip over this part due to the lack of time, but essentially starting with military, business persons, all Americans, forming branches, and then slowly inviting Italian natives to join the church. In February 1965, missionaries were sent from the Swiss mission to begin proselyting in Italy again, following the granting of permission from the Italian government. These missionaries did not proselyte the Waldensians, which had roughly the same number of members they had in 1850, or 20,000, but instead tracted the industrial cities of Turin, Milan, Florence, and Rome. Nevertheless, in November 1966, Ezra Taft Benson dedicated the Italian mission at the same location in Torre Pellice where Lorenzo Snow had begun the mission 116 years earlier. The dedication had originally been scheduled to take place in Florence, but the flooding of the Arno River had caused the LDS apostle to change his plans. At the time of the dedication, there were only two Italian branches and seven servicemen branches opened and operating in Italy. Even though Mormons were allowed to proselyte, they were not legally recognized by the government. In 1984, the Italian government renegotiated the Lateran Treaty with the Vatican. Under the treaty, it was agreed that the Catholic Church would no longer be the official state religion. Even before that time, the state had begun to recognize, on a limited basis, minority religions which have a significant following, although the definition of significant is not given. Even though Mormon missionaries were granted permission to proselyte in Italy beginning in 1965, the church was not otherwise recognized as a charitable organization entitled to tax deductions or allowed to own property, and Mormon bishops did not have legal recognition to perform valid marriages. The religious groups which remained in Italy despite prohibitions against proselytism, on the other hand, began to achieve recognition shortly after the end of World War II. Negotiations on behalf of the LDS Church culminated only in February of 1993, when the President of Italy signed a decree which finally formally recognized the LDS Church for purposes of land ownership, tax benefits, and validity of marriages. This recognition places the LDS Church in a very select company, with Roman Catholics, Jehovah's Witnesses, the Waldensians, Seventh-day Adventists, Assemblies of God, Baptists, Methodists, Jews, Muslims, and Buddhists. Even though there are only about 16,000 Mormons in Italy today compared to 450,000 Jehovah's Witnesses and many more Seventh-day Adventists and other minority religions, the church has achieved the form of legal recognition that eluded Lorenzo Snow 150 years earlier. It is likely that there would be many more Mormons, perhaps even as many as the Jehovah's Witnesses in Italy, but for the concept of gathering and the failure to maintain any presence in Italy for 100 years between 1867 and 1966. It is also likely that the church would be in a better numbers position if it had sent missionaries to Italy in 1946 rather than 1966. The same is true in Eastern Europe. The church is playing catch-up because many of the competing new religious movements refuse to obey communist prohibitions against proselytism. Thus, it is likely that the road to achieving legal recognition will also lag in many of those countries, just as it did in Italy. Thank you.
We have some time left for some questions. Since this is being taped, if you have a question, I wish that you would come up to the front and state it in the microphone so I don't have to restate a question. Will you come? You may address your question to any individual panelist or just throw it out for general.
My question is directed to David Knowlton. And I would like his advice, having been over the road, and I do mean over the road, of what people who agree with his thinking about our international handling, what we who care about that should do. We know what you've done, and we know what happened. Most of us aren't that brave or that young.
Would that I had the wisdom of Solomon to answer that question. Forgive me for standing in front of you while I think, but the question is a very serious and a very demanding question, and it really requires a very thoughtful response. What to do, in a sense, depends on how you frame the issues and how you frame the questions. I think in some ways we need to spend some time thinking about how we frame and what we do. Speaking of experience, I know that one of the reasons I got into trouble was because I succumbed to the temptation here at Sunstone to answer precisely the question you posed to me, what to do. We as Americans are very pragmatic people. Would that we were French and much more theoretical. I'm an academic, meaning that I'm very good at thinking about the problems, not so good at thinking about answers. Pragmatism escapes me in many ways. I'm answering as honestly as I can. As an academic, I say we need to talk a lot more and think and work it out. And in some ways, our talking filters up there and their talking filters down here in different ways. But it filters. But you know, even more, we need to pose to ourselves one of the really fundamental questions. This is not having to do only with the International Church, because it seems to me, I'll tell the question in just a minute, the issues of the International Church are also issues that come under the heading of the Second Commandment. Namely, love thy neighbor as thyself. What does it mean to love somebody who persists in doing things that are offensive to me? Do I have to change them? How can I accept them? How can I not feel threatened? What is required of other people in order to engage with them? It seems to me that the answer to whatever the gospel is hinges on those on the question of what does it mean to love the Lord and what does it mean to love your neighbor? The question of loving one's neighbor is an extremely difficult one, and I won't pretend that I'm a philosopher like Levinas or even like many others who've dealt with the issue. I don't know. I know practically it's very, very difficult. I spent years working in Bolivia. I was a missionary in Bolivia 20 years ago. You know, it was awfully simple 20 years ago to tell the gospel. It's very hard now. And part of the reason it's very hard is because I have a real respect for Bolivian culture and for Bolivian ways of life. I understand the beauty, the elegance of it. And I'm amazed at the marvelous ways that Bolivians go about syncretizing my Anglo-Mormon gospel with their way and create new things. And I really think it's great and I don't want them to change. But I'm also fascinated and amazed by the people who don't ever want to be Mormon. But that troubles me because I'm also LDS. And I have this commitment to carry the gospel into all the world. Personally, I don't know the answer to your question. I know that it hinges on that commandment. And for me, that's a lifelong struggle to figure out what that means. In terms of politics, of how do we deal with the real politics of the church, the real communication of messages, we're doing it right now. We do it also by becoming mission presidents and facing it firsthand, by working in our wards with cultural diversity. We don't have to go abroad to find the problems of cultural diversity. They're right here. I almost told you a story of a woman from Santo Domingo who grew up in New York City, who's a student at BYU, not one of mine, although she started escaping her Book of Mormon class to come to my very theoretical class on ethnicity, not because she was interested in what I was saying, just because there she felt a safe place. One day after class, we were talking, and she just started sobbing. Her culture, from New York City, Santo Domingo style, didn't fit with Anglo-BYU. And the hardest part is that the Anglo-BYU people had no way of dialoguing with her, because to be a good Mormon, she had to change. In a sense, we need to talk. We need to dialogue. We need to be able to pose these questions of difference and say, okay, you're different. Your way of doing the culture is different. We can pose the question to the Lord, and we can pose it to each other. But we have to be ready for the answers to be very complicated. And part of that complexity is we have to recognize our culture, our biases, our preferences may not be the Lord's way. And when I'm saying that, I'm not talking about simple things like Wasatch Front norms and values, or Santa Claus, or road shows. I'm talking about very core things. What is God? What does it mean to worship God? What does it mean to interact with each other? Other people's answers in engaging the Lord may be very different. The gospel comes to us in language. And when we put it in language, we put it in our culture, meaning that already we've committed one of the greatest acts of apostasy. But the irony is, if we don't do it, there is no gospel. Go figure. I don't have the answer to your question. Forgive me for not answering. And I'm doing a lot of not answering in lots of words today. But the question's a great one, and I honestly pray that we'll give lots of thought to it. The church will be successful whether we do or don't, most likely. But that's not the issue, not numbers. The issue is salvation. And I don't know what that means anymore, although I pray the Lord that I might make it, and that you might make it, and that everybody in the world might make it, and that in the celestial kingdom we'll still have cultural difference, because it'll be a lot more fun. Thank you.
Since that's such a good question, I'm going to ask if other members of the panel would like to address it. I know Brooke would, and I don't know.
That was a wonderful response, and I don't presume to add anything. Agree with a lot of what Professor Knowlton has said. you know, what I've experienced, though, and I wanted to give just a couple of examples as part of the complexity that you were speaking about, is I'm bothered somewhat by the idea that, I mean, I think it might be true, but I'm bothered by the idea that church is culture, church is totally all-inclusive, and it doesn't just have to do with the commandments to have some order or authority. It does have to do somewhat with the notion of the Savior, that there be some unity of effort, that there be some idea of his people. And I just wanted to give some really practical examples that I think might make some sense. One is a couple of these follow right along, and they're really messy ones. But another one is really disturbing. Should you as a church agree with the Swiss that none of the Chileans can have positions because they come an hour late to church? Therefore, they're not serious people, and a symbol of our culture is the clock. Should you agree with the French that you don't pass out the especially for youth pamphlets because we don't talk about sex because it's too private? I mean, maybe you should. But I'm just adding to the disturbing questions. Should you agree that it's okay for the ward mission leader to smoke, which he did, and passing out Books of Mormon at the same time, and, you know, and driving a taxi? Should you agree that that there can be no English language courses or translations in the Geneva Ward because it's too American, when the stakes are not just facilitation. The stakes are that all of the Philippine members are abandoning the church because they can't understand. You know, from a gospel point of view, does that make sense? There's a sort of hegemony the other way. And let me give you the most shocking example of all. Should you agree that Joe, a Nigerian from a polygamous family, should beat his wife with telephone cords until she's sent to the hospital because that's what we do in the Nigerian culture when wives ask us questions about where we were last night? So where do we draw the line between what we accept as core gospel and what we accept as culture? It's really very difficult.
I'd like to ask panel members an issue of organizational control, and that is, two friends of mine who are ex-regional representatives on west, east coast of this country have complained to me the preoccupation, the perceived preoccupation of Salt Lake with centralization of control. And that's just in this country. And from your experiences, is centralized organizational control more de jure than de facto, or is there more de facto autonomy the farther you get away in the international church than there may be in this country?
To answer that question, I need a grant from a major foundation and go and spend 5 years really studying this, so I would have more examples to give you. But the intention is one of control for many reasons, both financial reasons, but also the missionary system, but also publications, and also correlation to see that the rules are being followed. So there is no doubt, my experiences, whether Africa, Indonesia, a lot of other places, has been one to the degree possible through regional representatives, but also because of the church buildings that are taking place throughout Latin America especially, and in the Philippines and so on. The one of control of those buildings, are the permits, and how one deals with this financially is a major issue. And it's not one of locally being able to finance them primarily or something else, so both in design of buildings but everything else. So at least my experience would have been to the degree possible to have as much control as you can. I do know in some countries, because of different regions and very few members in some areas, then this becomes a real local issue, how you deal with it. The idea developed in Jakarta, our headquarters were in Jakarta, that I was in charge of the welfare system. Partly because of destitution, they'd come around, could you please help us, Brother Black? Could you please help us buy some medicine? Someone is sick. I'm just the branch presidency. I'm not the president. But how do you administer a welfare system in a world where the problems are there? It's even a problem in stakes here and in wards. I live in a very, I think, well-to-do stake area. But constantly they are saying the health costs of people needing health costs are greater than the amount coming in. Isn't that interesting? Partially translates into health costs, even in rich countries. But how do you deal with that and how do you administer it? Well, obviously, my job, I thought, was to try to help keep the patterns open, keep the paths open, and have people come but also do it. I think it's a good question and a real challenge. But I am sure if we were to study this in some of the new areas in Russia, and in lots of other areas on finding out the degree of local autonomy, our local initiative, and some of that's come up in the questions, the comments that have been made here, we would find a good deal of differentiation. We can even find that inside of one country, by the way, on how much initiative there is locally. Partially it's local leaders. It's even how the missionary system is working and lots of other things. Others may have better answers to it than I did.
I just want to make one little comment before we have another question about that. I'd like to just respond in terms of what Gloria Steinem says in her book, Revolution from Within. And she says, rather than going to different peoples and say, we'll help you do this or we'll help you do that, we need to go to different peoples and say, what would you like us to do? And give them the opportunity to tell us, rather than assume that we know what they need.
Professor Knowlton, would you say that the appeal of Mormonism in third world countries is more for the restored gospel or more for economic and social benefits?
Well, you all should be in graduate school. You're great at asking very hard questions. And I have to respond again like a good academic. The distinction between economic and gospel reasons is not a distinction that is tenable necessarily in other cultures. I'm reminded of the mother of the family in Bolivia that I have lived with for many, many years. She always says, my son, he loves me so much, he always sends me this, that, or the other thing. Fill in the blank. My daughter, she loves me so much, she always brings me this, that, or the other thing, or always does this, that, or the other thing. Or that virgin, she isn't Mormon, that virgin of Copacabana, she doesn't like me because when I went to pray for her afterwards, I fell down and broke my arm. She made me break my arm. She doesn't like me. If you listen very carefully to those words, there is no separation between spiritual and material. They're together. They're combined. I don't think you can easily separate, in terms of understanding the attraction of the church, whether people are coming to the revealed gospel or whether they're coming because we have sold ourselves as an American church. We've packaged Americanism. Or whether they come because maybe they can get scholarships to the United States. Why do we go to church? Is it only for spiritual reasons? Only for gospel reasons? In my own case, and this is a question to go to what Sister Thomas referred to, in a sense, that I've posed to myself many times. Why do I stay in this church? Well, there's a thing called testimony, yeah. But is that the most important? I wonder. The sociologists tell us that the reason people stay in churches has a lot more to do with their friendship networks. Well, that's true, too. Other than a few very good exceptions, almost all my friends are Latter-day Saints. My family's Mormon. My heritage is Mormon. If I were to leave, where do I go? What do I do? In other words, there are very strong pragmatic reasons for staying. Does that in any way say my testimony isn't strong? Well, to many people it does, I suppose, but I don't think so. Because it comes as a whole package, in my way of thinking, perhaps influenced by Bolivia. But let me speak again as an academic. We need to do studies, like I said, of what the church means. Why people are becoming Mormons? And what are they doing with Mormonism? How is the church bureaucracy interacting with them? We can speak about the church as the gospel as not being a culture, in the sense that there is now an international church that is building extra cultural, if you will, in the local sense, ties that's institutionalized in bureaucracy and has a procedure. But even so, in an anthropological sense, that's still culture. The thing is that we've separated it out. Okay? And so when we pose the question you're posing, in a sense, institutionally, we might, if we did that institutionally, we might be posing a question that's built on our cultural values that might very completely misperceive what people are actually doing when they come to the church. So we need studies of how the bureaucracy is formed, how it develops internationally, how it's creating a gospel culture, and how it's imposing that using political and other power, economic power as well, on other people, how they're contesting it, responding it, working with it, and so on. Thank you.
This is a question for any of the panelists. What, either formally or informally, is the church administration doing to sort of react or plan for the extension of boundaries in the church as it applies to culture? And what might it do?
I think you're asking the wrong group. Does anyone know specifically what the church is doing in terms of this?
I wish I could respond to it, but I don't have enough details on that, what the administration.
I know that the church does some studies, and but that's as much as I can say, and I don't know in what areas and what they pertain to, but I think there are some studies being done.
There is a big study, as I understand it, going on by that research group that looks at a lot of cross-cultural issues, but I don't think the data's in. I just wanted to say one thing in relation to Tony's question. If you think of the people out there and you think of the church as some big centralized things, there were two things that really amazed me. In Switzerland, the notion was that the church was too loosey-goosey American. It wasn't strict enough. I mean, the whole idea is, I mean, that's a really American thing, you know, here are the guidelines, go out and do it, be entrepreneurial. They felt very uncomfortable with that. I think they even felt that Elder Perry, one of the 12 coming, he was just too loose. He wasn't, you know, he wasn't powerful enough, centralized enough. In France, you know, I don't know that it means that much, but in terms of following rules, there's a really wonderful French example that happened to me. We're looking down there to find a way to baptize somebody on a Sunday during Sunday school. I say the American thing. Look, let's just do it, and then we'll tell them afterwards. It's easier to get forgiveness. Yeah, it's a really American thing than to ask the rules. The French say, no, they'd see us as a bunch of incompetents. There's always a rule for getting around the rule. They're going through there, and they finally find one. The Swiss would probably have said, neither of those. We'll just debate the rules till we come up with it. But the whole idea of organization and centralization and rules is itself a cultural artifact. So
we're right out of time. We'll entertain. Do you want to just have a quick question, and that will be our end.
This is for any of the panelists. I've always felt that it's important for people who are going to another culture to understand something about that culture, background, and so on, and you folks have alluded to that. And yet it's my understanding that the Missionary Training Center in Provo has dropped all the culture lessons. Is that true, and is there any comments on that? Can you enlighten us as to give us any insight as to why?
Someone from MTC would be better to answer this than I do. I thought they still used the culture grams down from the Kennedy Center, and those are even expanding more widely around the world, and they had advertisements not too long ago wanting writers to fill in from some of the new nations of the former Soviet Union and so on. So the culture grams that try to spell out things about something, they are not like a deep book on sociology of that culture. But it's one that is really brief. Anyone have any different information on that? Clyde, are they still? All right. This comment was from Professor Sullivan Emeritus, who's been down there at the BYU for a long time, and he says they still use the culture grams and bring people in to help out as well. But it is a real challenge, and some of the questions raised here about how much you emphasize one thing over another is really a challenge. Thank you.
Our son at the MTC has been practicing giving a lesson in English, and he said, now next week we've got to do it to some inactive people in Spanish. And my husband and I said to each other, gee, how do they go out and recruit inactive Spanish people to come so these missionaries can practice on them? I don't know. Well, thank you for coming. That ends the session, and we thank our panelists very much. I thought it was very interesting.